Okay, so this is Bio 241, and it's Thursday, September 18th, and we're in the middle of Chapter 6, so we're going to finish, I think we're going to finish Chapter 6 up tonight, maybe. It's going to be close. And we were just talking about carrier-mediated transport and how it is characterized by these three different terms. Let me get the pointer options working right here. Arrow visible. Okay, specificity. What does specificity mean? For a single molecule, that's right. There's an active site or a special binding site on the transporter. And what's the relationship between that binding site and the molecule that's being transported? That's right. It has to have the right shape. So the carrier molecule has the shape that's complementary to the substrate that's going to be transported through the membrane. We sometimes consider that the lock and key model. Right, or maybe hand in glove or something of that nature, but it's basically the shape of the active site has to match that of the molecule that's being transported. And what about competition? What does that mean? That means if there's two molecules that have very similar shapes, they will bind to the same transporter. And let's just say that the two molecules now are X and Y, so X is very similar to Y and vice versa, so not only does X fit in the binding site, it has the proper shape, but Y has the proper shape to fit in as well, so they both can go in there. And when Y goes into the binding site, that prevents X from getting in there, and if X can't get into the binding site, it can't be transported across the membrane. So that lowers what the maximum transport or the TM when you have a competitor in solution as well. Okay, so but these two molecules have to be very similar, very, very similar. Because if they're not similar, what, then Y won't bind to the binding site and it won't affect the transport of X one way or the other, and that's what we would call, what, specificity. Okay. So competition is the lowering of TM due to the binding of a second kind of molecule that takes or sequesters those binding sites away from the X molecule. And saturation. What was that? I think we've maybe talked about saturation. No, not quite. Saturation just means that in order for this molecule X to go across the membrane, it's got to bind to that transporter molecule, and there's only a certain number of transporter molecules on the membrane. And when they are completely bound with X, it doesn't matter if we put more X into solution or not, because all the transporters are busy doing their job. We can't force more X molecules across the membrane. So the maximum transport rate reaches a plateau, and it stays at that plateau even though the concentration of X is increasing. The rate stays the same because all the transporters are busy doing their job. All right? So that's what saturation is, and it's characterized by T sub M. That's the transport mechanism, transport maximum right here. So I have a question. If we were to double the number of carrier-mediated transporters in the membrane, if we were to double the number of transporters in the membrane, what would happen to TM? It would?
Double.
It would double as well. Okay, so it would continue increasing as the concentration of X increased. So if you have twice as many cars taking people across the bridge, right, you can carry twice as many people across the bridge at the same time. But if we cut the number of cars back, then we can't transport as many people across the bridge. The same thing for X right here. If we cut back the number of carriers for X, then the rate of X is going to decrease. The rate of X going across the membrane is going to decrease. We call that saturation. Okay, so carrier-mediated transport is good for molecules that are too large to go across the membrane, or what else? What kind of molecules can go across the membrane? Nonpolar or lipid-soluble, because the internal part of the membrane is lipid in nature, so only nonpolar molecules can diffuse across a plasma membrane. Polar molecules need help. Polar molecules need help via carrier-mediated transport to diffuse. That would be an example of facilitated diffusion across the membrane by protein carriers. Can you recall what kind of atoms produce polar bonds? What kind of atoms produce polar bonds? Yeah, a polar bond is covalent. But what kind of atoms? So let me put, I should put that on the periodic table. That's what I'm asking. So what's an atom? Like hydrogen, sulfur, sodium, potassium. What kind of atoms? You had a list to know which kind of atoms would produce a polar bond when it binds to, for instance, what? A hydrogen. So X, what's X? What will produce a polar bond? What kind of atom right here is going to pull this this one electron from this hydrogen atom way into itself? Oxygen, right? Perfect and really good, easy example, right? H2O. Pull those electrons. So oxygen does. What's another one? Sulfur, phosphorus, nitrogen. But, and this is the interesting thing, carbon does not. Carbon doesn't form a polar bond. So if we have a big chain of carbon with hydrogens on it like this, right, these are all nonpolar. This electron can still stay over in this area, and therefore the negative charge cancels out the positive charge in this nucleus, and it looks nonpolar. So hydrocarbons are nonpolar. They are hydrophobic as a result of that. Okay, but oxygen atoms will pull that electron over. Sulfur atoms, phosphorus atoms will. So instead of a hydrocarbon like this, we get something that looks like this. What kind of molecule does this look like? Yeah, so far, glycerol. All right, this one right here. What is carbon H2O? Carbon H2O, that's a carbon hydrate. What's a carbon hydrate? That's a carbohydrate. So this is just a general form for a carbohydrate. All right, and here we have an oxygen bound to an H, right, and an oxygen bound to an H. So what kind of bond is this right here? You see that kind of looks like this water molecule right here? So this is a polar covalent bond. So even though glucose doesn't have any charges on it, glucose is not an ion, it is still a polar compound because it has all these oxygens on it. And because it's a polar compound, can it cross the membrane? It can't get across the membrane. Even though glucose is a very important molecule and your cells have to have it to stay alive, by its nature, it cannot cross the cell membrane because of all of these polar covalent bonds on every carbon atom, right? Because oxygen, what? Forms polar covalent bonds with hydrogen. So glucose can't get across the membrane. So if you have an important molecule that needs to go across the membrane but can't because it's polar, how is that situation resolved? How's that solved? How does biology solve that? With carrier-mediated transport. Okay, so there are transporters that do that. Okay, so that's when we're going to talk about facilitated diffusion. So the word that you're familiar with right now is diffusion. What does that mean? So that means that a solute is going to move from high concentration to low. Is it going to require energy? Nope, no energy required. And so here we have a bunch of glucose molecules, but even though it's not an ion, it's still very polar. Why is it polar? Because it has all these OH groups on it. That produces polar covalent bonds, can't get through the plasma membrane. Even though high concentration outside, low concentration inside, which way is the force for glucose moving? Is it not going to want to move across the membrane, or does it want to move out, or does it want to move in passively? It wants to move in. So it wants to move in, but it can't because of this nonpolar region right here. So the cell solves that problem with a carrier protein that's in the membrane, right? So think of not just a phospholipid bilayer, but you got to think of the fluid mosaic model as well. Here's a protein that has a binding site, and you can see the binding site is complementary to the shape of the glucose molecule. So anything that has this shape will bind to this binding site, and when it does, it's going to change the conformation of this protein. Instead of open to the extracellular space, it's going to flip and open to the inside of the cell. And when it does that, it's going to kick out the glucose, and glucose will end up inside the cell. So now it doesn't have to diffuse through the membrane, but nonetheless, it's still going from what? High concentration to low through the membrane via this carrier-mediated transport right here. Now, this protein still cannot take glucose. Glucose can't come from inside the cell, bind, and then be pushed out of the cell to a higher concentration. In order for that to happen, what would you need? You would need for this protein to be able to bind an ATP molecule and burn it up, right? It would have to utilize ATP to move molecules from low to high concentration. Okay, did we talk about a protein that uses ATP that can move molecules across the membrane from low to high? Generally, what do we call that? That's active transport. That is active transport, and that protein would be called a? I don't think I mentioned it yet. Maybe I did. Okay. All right. So, your cells, most cells in the body, there's some other interesting information on this slide right here besides this facilitated transporter for glucose. And that is, not all cells in the body can or have these transporters in the membrane. Okay, you probably are familiar with a number or a disease process called diabetes mellitus. And with diabetes mellitus, if there's high glucose concentration outside the cell, that glucose can't get in. And where does it stay? It stays high in the blood. Okay, so that's the basic problem with diabetes mellitus. And so somebody that's suffering from diabetes, okay, doesn't have this mechanism working properly. And these transporters are not living in the membrane continuously, but they're put there only when glucose concentration is high in the normal individual. So that's what we want to look at over here. So here we have the cell membrane with glucose transporters. Here we have a cell membrane, and you see any glucose transporters in there? None whatsoever. So when somebody is in a normal person, when they're in a fasted state, when their blood glucose level is normal, okay, there are no glucose transporters in the membrane. So that's just what? That maintains their blood glucose concentration at a normal level. But as soon as they eat something, what happens to blood glucose concentration? It goes up, okay? And it wants to get in the cell, but it can't because there are no glucose transporters here. And what happens is that there are glucose receptors in the pancreas that see blood glucose increasing, and the pancreas releases a signal that's going to take these glucose transporters that are in a vesicle inside the cell and have this vesicle fuse to the plasma membrane. And when this vesicle fuses to the plasma membrane, now what have we put in the plasma membrane? These transporters. So now the transporters are in the membrane, and they will allow glucose uptake by this cell. So what's the name of that signal from the pancreas that takes these transporters that are in reserve in the cytoplasm on this vesicle and puts it into the plasma membrane? It's a hormone. And that hormone is called insulin. So that's why I say insulin is a passport that glucose needs to enter most cells of the body. Right? So when insulin is given, this vesicle right here, your book doesn't do a real good job with this vesicle. This is what is called an endosome. So you know a number of names of vesicles. You know what? Lysosome. Lysosome. What's another zome you know? Peroxisome. Lysosome is what now? Digestion. Peroxisome is detoxification. Endosome. Okay, endosome, I'm just going to say routing. It can route various membrane components. It can put components in the membrane or take them out of the membrane. And if it's out of the membrane, it's in this endosome. But why is that really cool? Because if you need this these glucose transporters in a hurry, do you have to build them? Do you have to, like, start protein synthesis and get the nucleus involved and get all the ribosomes involved and find the amino acids to make them and stick them in the membrane? You don't have to, because why? They're right there. Okay, this is like a garage for these glucose transporters, and as soon as it gets the signal, they pop into the membrane. You don't have to wait and worry about making them. They're there ready to go to work. All you have to do is put them in the membrane, and the cell can start taking up glucose. And the signal for putting these transporters in the membrane, once again, is called insulin, right? And when they're in the membrane, because insulin is the signal, what happens to blood glucose concentration? It goes down. It goes back down to normal. And the glucose gets into the cell and keeps the cell alive. Okay. So that process, you see any ATP being used right here for moving glucose across. It's passive. And since it's passive, but it's being facilitated by these proteins, so we call that facilitated diffusion. Yeah. Yeah, it's just routing this membrane transporter right here. It's either putting it in the plasma membrane or taking it out and just storing it inside the cell. And these transporters can be put back in the membrane just in a split second notice. And the notice is what? The signal insulin puts them back in there. Okay. All right, so that's that slide. All right, now here is a little something a little bit different, nicely titled, active transport. All right, so here we have a nice phospholipid bilayer again with some kind of transporter protein. You can see that there's a channel right here. And usually in a cell or in your body, we have high concentration of calcium. Ca is what? Calcium, and it's an ion. Can that ion move across the cell membrane? It can. It's a polar molecule. It's an ion. They don't go through because of this hydrophobic region. It needs a channel. All right. So in this particular case, the cell is maintaining low calcium inside of itself, and it is pushing it outside the cell. But can that happen by diffusion? The cell wants calcium to go from low concentration to high outside. Can that happen by diffusion? No, because diffusion only goes the opposite, only from high to low. All right, so in this particular case, calcium, which is low inside the cell, can enter this carrier and bind to a site on that carrier. There is another site on this carrier, for instance, right here, that can bind an ATP molecule. And then the ATP molecule is going to be broken down into ADP plus inorganic phosphate plus something else. What does ATP get broken down into? ATP can be broken down into ADP, right? The diphosphate, plus here's the third one that's off by itself now, inorganic phosphate, plus AMP, close. AMP would still be in here, okay? Yeah, plus, it's not a molecule, it's sort of a little ephemeral thing, but it's real important. It is energy, okay? Because there is energy in ATP, and when we break it up, that's a nice catabolic reaction. When we have large molecules, break them into small, energy is always released. And ATP is fantastic at that because the last two bonds, these last two interphosphate bonds, are high energy, even more than a normal covalent bond. And that can be used for cellular purposes, and in this particular purpose, what is that energy used for? Changing the conformation of this protein from being closed to the outside, kind of like going through a little teeter-totter mechanism, flipping, and now closed to the inside and open to the outside. And when that happens, then calcium is effectively what? Outside the cell. So calcium has gone from low to high by this membrane protein, all right, using the energy in ATP to cause this conformation change in the protein. All right, so this kind of protein that is moving ions or any kind of molecule from low to high that's active transport, we give this protein kind of a slang term, right? But we use it all the time. What do you call something that can take water that's way down in the ground and bring it up to the surface so that you can drink it? What do you call that? Well, the well is where the water is. You want to get water out of the well up to you so that you can drink it. What's the name of that mechanism that you use to get water out of the ground so that you can drink it? Going from low to high. Going from low to high. You're going to kick yourselves when I tell you. You all know the answer. But I mean, It's, well, the bucket is what you catch the water in. But what's the mechanism that you use to catch the water in that's down under the ground? It's a pump. That's just a pump. Oh, you were saying pump? I can't hear you. Sorry. Okay, a pump. You're right. Exactly. Perfect. So this protein right here is what we call a pump, because it can move things from low concentration to high, as long as you have what? ATP. Okay? Yeah. PI, inorganic phosphate, And inorganic phosphate is this kind of molecule. All right, so that's inorganic phosphate. So it's not just phosphate. It's phosphate with a bunch of oxygens or OHs around it. It's a little bit more complicated. So instead of drawing this out all the time, or instead of saying PO4, 2 minus, et cetera, I just say PI, inorganic phosphate, okay? All right. So this is a pump. So active transport, so when you look at a diagram and you don't see any ATP, what should you be thinking of automatically? If you don't see ATP, you should be thinking of facilitated diffusion, for instance, if things are going from high to low. But if things are going from low to high and ATP, that's active transport. Okay, active transport. Because it's using the energy in ATP to pump these calcium ions from low concentration to high. Okay. All right, here's another pump. Oh, I should have showed you this slide. Here's another pump. And why do we call this a pump? Because it's taking water, right, from the ground up to the surface. But we don't see water here moving. What do we see? We see ATP. Good clue. Right, that is an active transport mechanism. All right, and we also know that this is a pump because we see potassium going from low concentration to high concentration. Can't happen automatically. We see sodium going from low concentration to high concentration. Can't happen automatically. That needs ATP. This is a kind of fancy pump because it's going to pump both potassium and sodium at the same time against their concentration gradient. It's only going to require one ATP. This is what we call the sodium-potassium ATP pump, or sodium-potassium pump. And all cells that are alive that have ATP operate these pumps. So under normal resting conditions, they're on one side of the membrane you have high potassium concentration, and on the other side of the membrane you have high sodium concentration. So this you just have to burn into your memory. What side of the membrane has high concentration, or what side of the cell has high sodium concentration? Inside or outside? It's outside. And where is high potassium? It's inside the cell. And it's partly maintained that way by what? This sodium-potassium pump right here. Okay. All right, so this pump can move things against their concentration gradient. Let's see what else we have here. Okay. I guess I can leave that on the board for a second or so. As a matter of fact, I do want to go back. I want to go back one. This right here, this slide right here, someplace. Oh, I could do that. There's a previous button here. Okay. This right here is this active transport or passive? It's active because you see ATP. Okay. You also know it's active because sodium is going from high to low. Potassium is going from, sodium is going from low to high. Potassium is going from low to high. That means it's active transport. Can't happen automatically. Requires ATP to do that. So whenever we have a pump that uses energy and ATP to move things up their concentration gradient, namely from low to high, we call that primary active transport. So that means primary active transport. Primary active transport uses ATP as energy. Okay, but a cell has other forms of energy besides ATP. Let's go back to my car real quick. All right, so here we have something. What is this right here that I'm drawing? Kind of looks like a fish. But a leaf is really good too. A leaf is a good example, or a feather. Okay? So here we have a feather, and it's at the bottom of the hill, right? And will this feather move up the hill all by itself? Can it do that? No, because it would need what? Energy to move up the hill. It could go down the hill by itself, right, by just a passive mechanism, but it can't go up. All right, what about my car without the engine on? Without the engine on, can it go up the hill? No. How can it go up the hill? Using energy of some kind, like gasoline, right? Okay, so here's my car at the bottom of the hill. Let's drive up the hill using gasoline, and where is it now? It's on top of the hill right here. But it only got up there because why? We put energy into it to get it up with gasoline. All right, so now here we are. Now the car has potential energy because it can roll down the hill all by itself without using gasoline, right? And you just told me that this feather can't go up the hill without using some kind of energy. It doesn't have an engine or anything like that, can't use gasoline. But let's move it up the hill. How could you move that feather up the hill without using gasoline or some kind of engine? Okay, let's look at this. Let's put a pulley right here, a stationary wheel, and we'll just tie it to the ground so it doesn't move, so it's a pulley. Tie a rope onto this feather right here, bring it up the hill, wrap it around this pulley like this, and do what? Fix it to the car. And now, what can we do? Even without turning the car engine on, we can do what? We can push it down, get it started, have it going down the hill without the engine on. That's just a passive, what, going from high to low. And when it goes down the hill, what's going to happen to that feather? It's going to get yanked up the hill. So there is energy in the gradient of this car right here to move things from low concentration to high. So it is actively moving this feather up the hill, but it's not using gasoline. This is not primary active transport. This would be an example of what we call secondary active transport. When the feather that's moving up the hill is coupled to something else doing what? Going down the hill. But it takes energy to get that car up on the hill. It takes energy to make a gradient. Okay, so the motion of this feather up the hill is what we call secondary active transport. And in your book, it gives you another analogy, another example. So let's look at this other example.
So when is this primary?
It's primary active transport. Where is the previous? It's primary active transport. Oh, look where my cursor is. It's primary active transport when the energy is ATP. So when the energy is ATP, if you see ATP being involved, that's primary active transport. But if you don't see any ATP, I don't see any ATP used here, but I see a gradient. If a gradient is being used to move something up the hill or up the concentration gradient, that's what we call secondary active transport. But in order to have something within a gradient, ATP had to be used at some time, just not immediately during this circumstance. Okay? All right, so let's look at that next slide. All right, so here we have a sodium molecule, and we're going to push it up a hill. All right, so here is a low concentration. Here's a high concentration of sodium. How can we get sodium from low concentration to high concentration across the membrane? That's ATP, the sodium potassium ATP pump. All right, so if it's using ATP, what kind of transport is this? That's active transport, but in particular, what kind of active transport? It's primary because it's using ATP, and that'd be really nice if I could change the slide to put ATP right here. Okay? So as a matter of fact, put a big ATP because that's what this pump requires, right? Any kind of pump requires ATP. So we get sodium going up its concentration gradient. And when it's up there, all right, what does it want to do? It wants to go back down by diffusion all by itself automatically. So we can push it off the edge. And as it's falling off, right? This little cliff right here going down its concentration gradient, we can couple it to another mechanism like we did with the feather there, except this mechanism is a little teeter-totter. And on one side of the teeter-totter, we got a big, heavy glucose molecule. And will glucose want to go from low concentration to high all by itself? Just like this feather. Will this feather want to go up the hill all by itself? It does not want to do that, right? But if we have this teeter-totter mechanism, when we take this energy of sodium moving down its concentration gradient, it hits the teeter-totter, and what's it going to do to glucose? It's going to bounce it up, right? So over here, we see ATP being used, primary active transport. Over here, the energy is not ATP. There's no ATP. What energy is being used to bounce the glucose up? Just the sodium going down its concentration gradient. That energy is throwing glucose up, right? Just like when my car is rolling down the hill, that energy can be used to move the feather up the hill. Okay. Now that would be, so here's a pretty good slide that shows primary active transport because ATP is used over here, and this is what we call secondary active transport. Now I want to give you some real physiologic examples of this. Not just an analogy. This is just an analogy right here. Right. But anyway, the other thing is when this car, the energy in this car moving downhill has to be greater than the energy that's required to move this object up the hill. So for instance, if I had another car exactly the same as mine down here, what would happen? Nothing would move, right? So this thing has to be lighter than my car. So there has to be more energy of that sodium going down its concentration gradient than what glucose requires to go up. Otherwise, it won't happen.
And
the feather going up the hill, because it's not burning gasoline, that's secondary active transport. As long as, but that only happens when what? The car is moving down the hill. Okay? And again, we're not turning the engine on in this car. We're just letting it roll down the hill like it would normally do. And how did I use that secondary energy source? How did I use that? To start my car, right? I used the energy on top of the hill to get my engine started when the battery was dead. Okay, so that's just utilizing that potential energy in the gradient. So there is energy in the gradient. You might just want to jot that down. There is energy in the gradient that can be used. Okay, here we have an example of a transporter in a membrane. And we have extracellular fluid that has sodium, and here's the intracellular fluid. And where is sodium high? It's high on the outside of the cell, if it's a living cell. So sodium wants to diffuse in, right? That's like my car rolling down the hill. And here's a glucose molecule. And let's just say that glucose concentration is high on the inside, so glucose doesn't want to move in the cell, but if we couple sodium and glucose transport together, and as long as there's a sufficient gradient in sodium, and that energy can be used to move glucose up its concentration gradient. All right, so both molecules bind to a binding site, changes the conformation in the transporter right here, so now it's open to the inside of the cell. Both sodium and glucose enter the cell. So sodium goes to the lower concentration, but glucose gets bumped up its concentration gradient. That's just like the previous slide without the teeter-totter, right? Here's sodium and here's glucose. Right, so here's sodium and here's glucose. Sodium is going down its concentration gradient while glucose is going up its concentration gradient. So there is more energy in the movement of sodium from high to low than the energy that's necessary to move glucose from low to high. So glucose can enter the cell. So we have two molecules, and are they moving in the same direction or different directions? The same direction. So this kind of transporter is what we call, or this kind of mechanism we call co-transport, or symport. Symport is when two molecules are going in the same direction. And it's secondary active transport. How do you know this is secondary active transport right here, as opposed to, well, I tell you what, how do you know this is active transport? Because we have glucose, right? Glucose concentration is higher on this side. That means the inside of the membrane. So glucose is going from low to high. When something goes from low to high, what's that? That's active transport. All right. Now the second question I have is, what kind of active transport is that? Is that primary or secondary? If it's primary, what do you want to look for? ATP. See any ATP there? No. So this is secondary active transport, but you should also understand why it's called secondary active transport, because you're looking for energy in what? The gradient of sodium, the sodium gradient, which is high outside the cell and low inside the cell. That energy source can be used to move glucose. All right, so that's how you would analyze and look at those pictures in terms of secondary and primary active transport. Here is what really happens inside your body. And we have two processes right here. One is called absorption and the other is called reabsorption, but they can be modeled exactly the same way. Absorption is the transport of the products of digestion across the intestinal wall or epithelium into the blood. That's how we absorb things. In particular, we're talking about the absorption of glucose. Glucose is an important energy molecule. You don't want to be losing it in through your digestive tract. You want to absorb every single glucose molecule out of the food that you eat, even though inside your body it might be high glucose concentration. If there's one little glucose in your digestive tract, your body still wants it, right? It's going to take it from low to high with active transport. All right? Second, reabsorption transports glucose out of something that will become urine, right? But before it becomes urine, we call it filtrate, back into the blood. So there's plenty of glucose in the urine, or the precursor to urine, but do you want to be passing glucose in your urine? It's an important energy molecule. That would be very wasteful. That would be like going to the gas station, for instance, and filling up your gas tank in your car with gasoline, going home, putting a hole in the gas tank, and letting it run out on the ground, right? So you should not be losing any glucose in urine. Your body should be taking it all back so that you have energy, all right? So these are two processes. Now, how does that happen? Even if glucose goes from low concentration to high. So here we have, all right, this space up over here. Oh, well, here we have a membrane, right? So here's the apical surface of that membrane. Here's the basal region or basal lateral part of that membrane. Remember, the apical surface points or is associated with the free edge or open space of that epithelium. In this particular case, this is the lumen of a kidney tubule, or the inside tube of a kidney tubule, or the inside part of your intestine. Right, so this is the part of the tube. And then this is your body. Here's the blood. So glucose will be absorbed or reabsorbed from this tubule into the blood, or from the digestive tract into the blood. But it's got to go across this membrane right here first, this epithelium. And glucose can go from low concentration, okay, to a higher concentration, or being absorbed from this material right here, whether it's filtrate or digesting material in your intestinal tract. All right, so here we have high sodium. And what do you have? What kind of sodium do you have inside the cell? You have low. Okay, as a matter of fact, let's start right here. This is a better place to start. Here is a molecule, a protein in the membrane, and it can move sodium from low concentration to high in the blood, low concentration inside the cell. So in all living cells, you should have low sodium concentration. And so what kind of mechanism can take sodium from low to high? Okay. Here we go, ATP right here. So here is, what do we call this protein that moves sodium from low to high with the use of ATP? Okay, that is a pump. And in particular, the sodium-potassium pump, because potassium is being moved the other way. But again, from what? Low concentration to high. Potassium is going to be high inside the cell if it's a normal, healthy cell. So what kind of transport is this? Is it active or passive transport? Sodium is going from low to high. Low to high is active. So it's active transport, but now you should also classify it as to primary or secondary. Is it primary or secondary? And how do you know that's primary? Because there's this big yellow flashing sign right here with ATP in the inside of it, right? So this is primary active transport. Those molecules are being moved up their concentration gradient with this energy source. All right, so now we have what? Low sodium inside the cell. We have high sodium in the lumen of this kidney tubule. This sodium will want to do what? All by itself. Go from high to low. And what is really stored in this gradient right here? It is really energy, just like there's energy, chemical energy in ATP, but the energy is in that gradient. So sodium will want to flow in, but there's so much energy that it can drag something else along with it. And one beneficial molecule that will be dragged along with it is glucose. So glucose can go from low concentration to high as long as there is a gradient in sodium right here. Okay, so the gradient, the sodium gradient is going to actively move glucose from low concentration to high. But now what kind of transport is that? Let's talk about that a little bit. There are different ways you can think about it. What kind of transport for glucose is that? Oh, I'm sorry? I'm not sure I heard you. Some kind of transport, you said. Classic? Co-transport, but what the heck does that mean? It's combined. Co-transport means that sodium and glucose are going in the same direction. Otherwise, we call it, another name for that is a symport mechanism. Co-transport or symport are the same. But now what is it? Is that passive? Or active? And if it's active, what kind of active? Ah, this is a good mind teaser type. Ah, good clue. You don't see any ATP right here. So if it is active transport, it's got to be of the kind secondary. And I would agree with you, it is active transport because, why? Glucose is going from low to high. Something won't go from low to high all by itself, right? This feather can't go from low to high all by itself. It needs some kind of active mechanism. It needs energy to do that. And where's the energy? Where's the energy that moves glucose from low to high? It's the gradient of sodium, right? As sodium moves down its gradient, it can drag glucose along with it. There's enough energy in the sodium gradient to move glucose from low to high inside the cell. So the body is pretty ingenious, or life is ingenious, in how it's figured out how to put these little membranes, these proteins in the membrane to move things around. And then when glucose is high inside the cell, it will move out of this epithelium into the blood because it's low glucose in the blood. So that's what we call the process of something going from high to low. That is? That's passive. That's diffusion. Glucose can't get through the membrane because, remember, it's polar. So it needs this little carrier right here, but it doesn't require energy. So we call that facilitated diffusion. So this is a really important slide to be familiar with. Okay, I'm sure this is an exam figure. Okay, so low to high is active. You need energy to go up the hill. And you know now two active transport mechanisms, primary and secondary. Which one requires ATP? Primary. Which one just uses a gradient? Secondary. Yeah, so it should be pretty easy to tell, okay, which is which. Primary, secondary. So co-transport is a kind of secondary active transport that couples the movement of glucose with some kind of gradient right here, the movement of a second molecule down its concentration gradient. All right, spent a lot of time on that, but I think it's really worth it. Okay. These definitions actually are pretty simple. I don't think I'll spend a lot of time with these, but transcellular transport moves material from one side to the other of epithelial cells, like what we were just looking at. Okay, transcellular, it actually moves through the cell. Paracellular transport moves material through tiny spaces between the cells. And did we have any over here? Yeah, like for instance, transcellular moves material right through the cell. Paracellular transport will move something, okay, right between the cells like this. I'm losing my cursor. Right between the cells. So it doesn't have to go through the cell. But a lot of material can't move between the cell because the cells are tightly bound together by these junctional complexes. All right, so paracellular transport is limited by design. When the epithelium is made, those cells are glued together, okay, by junctional complexes. So many things can't move through between the cells. It has to go through the membrane itself through via transcellular transport. Okay. And this is just really that previous slide, okay, that again just shows these junctional complexes. They can be made out of adherens junctions or desmosomes, different kinds of things that glue cells together. Okay, another kind of transport that's not using membrane proteins, but it has to do with a topic we call bulk transport. And bulk transport always has to deal with vesicles one way or another inside the cell. And remember, this membrane around this vesicle is exactly like the membrane that the plasma membrane is made out of. So these vesicles can fuse or break away from the plasma membrane because they're the same material. All right, so here we have the extracellular fluid. Here's a cytoplasm or intracellular fluid. This process shows that a dimple is formed in the plasma membrane. So there are microtubules in ATP that's being used to pull on the cell membrane to form this little pocket. And when this pocket forms, it drags along with it some of these large particles that are in the extracellular fluid. And this pocket gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And finally, these walls or edges of that dimple that was formed touch each other, right, and actually pinches away so that we now have a free and independent vesicle inside the cell that's now separated itself from the plasma membrane. And inside the vesicle, you have the particles that were once on the outside of the cell. So now they're inside the cell, inside this vesicle. So this is a way for materials to what? Enter a cell, get inside the cell. And generally speaking, all right, we call that endocytosis. When materials are on the outside and they end up in a vesicle on the inside of the cell by the formation of this little pouch right here, we call that endocytosis. And there are two kinds of endocytosis. Two kinds of endocytosis. One is what we call phagocytosis. And another one is called pinocytosis. And so phago means eating. Cytosis is a cellular process. It's a process of cell eating. So large particles can be eaten. Pinocytosis is a cellular process, but pino means drinking. So cell drinking. So if it's a fluid, if they're just solutes in solution, the cell can bring those solutes into the cell by pinocytosis. And the opposite of endocytosis is exocytosis. Exocytosis. So the bottom series of slides shows exocytosis, where we have a product of cellular metabolism inside this vesicle. How did we get this product inside this vesicle? That's due to some kind of secretory pathway. Right, the rough endoplasmic reticulum produces a product that goes to the Golgi body, which modifies and packages it, and then puts it in this vesicle right here inside the cytoplasm. And then that microtubule system moves it over to the plasma membrane. It fuses with the plasma membrane. Right, the vesicle joins with the plasma membrane, and now the interior contents of that vesicle are secreted to the extracellular space. So this would be what we call exocytosis. And moving these vesicles around inside of the cell, right, is difficult. It needs energy. Guess what kind of energy it needs? ATP. And since it requires ATP, how would you classify endocytosis and exocytosis in terms of transmembrane transport, active or passive? It's active. So these are other examples of active transport. So these particles can actually go from low concentration to high. So if there's a toxic product inside the cell, it can get rid of it by exocytosis, even though it's even higher outside the cell. Right? It can be secreted via this kind of process right here.
They're both active?
They're both active because they require ATP to move that membrane around. That membrane just is not going to fold by itself and move around and form these vesicles. Okay, membrane potential. I maybe mentioned what potential means in here. This is kind of a funny term for this class because this is a biology class. But a fascinating thing of all biology is that it really is ruled by electrical activity. We are very electrical beings. It's just not something that really comes to our consciousness very often. Okay, I think you kind of know that by what? If somebody's heart stops, how do we get their heart started again? Yeah, we shock them with what? Electricity. Because the heart understands electricity very well. Or maybe you've touched electricity. What happens if you have ever touched electricity? You get shocked. Your muscles automatically contract, right? Okay, so this term, potential, right here, really is really just means voltage, membrane voltage. Potential is the ability to do something. And voltage gives electrical systems the ability to do something. Like in order to turn these lights on and off, what do we need? We need voltage to do that, the potential to turn them on, and we use a switch to control that voltage, right? Okay. So we want to look at the voltage across a membrane. And I'm going backwards. I don't want to go backwards. Oh, I must have been on the arrow. Okay. Okay. The membrane potential. Okay. So that's just a membrane voltage, and we can measure voltages or a voltage on a number on a device. What's a device that you can carry around with you that separates electrical charge and produces a voltage? And because there's a gradient in electrical charge, there's energy in this device. Remember I said there is energy in a gradient, a concentration gradient, but there's also energy in a gradient of electrical charge. If you have a lot of positive charge on one side of something and negative on the other, there's energy in that gradient because what do those charges really want to do? Positive and negative. They want to attract each other, right? They'll do anything to get together. So there is energy in that gradient. What do we carry around with us that has energy, that has voltage, have big voltage gradient? Cell phones, because cell phones have, if it's charged, they have a battery, right? So a battery, all right, is just a device that produces a gradient in electrical charge. And there, how many terminals does a battery have? Yeah, it's got two. It's got two terminals. And one is the plus terminal and one is the minus, or one is the plus and the other is the ground. Or there's a ground and the voltage can vary either plus or minus on the other side. So the battery in your car has two terminals, and you can measure the voltage on a battery with a voltmeter that has two terminals on it. And you can actually see if the battery has a voltage. And if the battery doesn't have a voltage, how do you call that battery?
Dead.
It's dead. That's right. And as a matter of fact, we can measure the voltage on a cell. We can put just a regular voltmeter that we use for a battery. We can put one electrode inside the cell and one outside, and it will measure a voltage across the membrane. So therefore, we call that a membrane potential or a membrane voltage. And when that voltage goes away, what can you tell me about that cell?
Dead.
It's dead, as a matter of fact. Okay, so let's look and see how this develops a little bit. Okay, so every cell in your body acts like a battery, and your cell uses that energy to send signals and to control various processes. So let's take a look at that. Matter of fact, maybe I'll start over here on the board first. Oh, there goes the feather. That's too bad. All right, so here we have a cell, and that's just a regular plasma membrane right there. But let's just say that it is permeable to potassium. Let's just put channels in this membrane so potassium can go in. So let's start with a lot of potassium on the outside of the cell and none on the inside. So a lot of potassium everywhere. And potassium is permeable to the membrane. What's going to happen to that potassium? Will it want to go inside the cell?
Yeah.
By what process?
Gradient.
Yeah, there's a gradient. So it's going to go from high to low. What's that process called?
Diffusion.
That is just passive transport or diffusion. because it's going to go from high to low. Potassium will just like if I open up a perfume bottle here, that perfume is going to fill up the room, right, just passively by diffusion. So potassium is going to go inside the cell. And when is diffusion going to stop? When? What? When the concentration of potassium inside the cell and outside is equal, right? When there's no concentration gradient, potassium is going to stop moving because the gradient is what moves things around for diffusion. Okay, so now we have equal concentrations of potassium. But in living cells, there's something special inside the cell. We have a lot of proteins inside the cell, and proteins have negative charges on them. We have nucleic acids that have negative charges on them. We have other molecules that have negative charges on them, right? And these are huge molecules that can't get through the membrane. So now we have potassium, equal concentration, but now we put all these negative signs inside the cell right here, right? How is that going to affect the movement of potassium across the membrane? Are these negative charges going to kick the potassium out or have no effect, or will it actually bring more potassium inside the cell? Yeah? Intuitively, you should have a sense that it's even going to bring more potassium inside the cell because why? Opposite charges attract each other. All right, so after a long period of time, we're going to have higher potassium inside the cell than outside. All right, so the concentration, just the concentration of potassium is going to be disturbed because we have these extra anions inside the cell. So you're going to have more potassium inside, less outside the cell. So what's that? That's a gradient of potassium. Okay. All right, so the membrane potential. It's a difference in charge across the membrane results in part from the presence of these large anions trapped inside the cell. They can't get out. These cations, like potassium, are attracted into the cell by these negative charges. And let's not pay attention to sodium right at the moment, because even in living cells, sodium is hardly permeable to the cell membrane. So these negative ions right here won't actually draw any more of them in. Okay, but potassium, there are channels for potassium in living cells. All right, but you already know what about potassium in a living cell? Is it higher on the inside or higher on the outside? It's higher on the inside, and this partly explains that. Okay, this partly explains that, because these negative charges are what? Drawing potassium in. All right, we haven't looked at any pumps yet. So that's just due to... All right, so we can put a voltmeter on this cell, and let's go back to this one right here. Okay, so now we have in this cell high potassium on the inside and low on the outside. So in terms of the concentration gradient, just the concentration of potassium, which way is that going to have a tendency to move potassium? Forget about electrical charge. Just think about concentration. It's going to want to move potassium out. This is due to what? Concentration. This is due to the concentration of potassium. Okay. But we just said that this is now at equilibrium. Potassium is not moving, but the gradient is trying to push it out. But that, since it's, nothing is moving, there's got to be something that's balancing it. What is the force that's balancing it, counteracting? Okay, these, right, this electricity inside the cell, these negative charges, right? So let's see, I'll put another arrow like this. Potassium is moving in. This is due to the charge gradient, to the charge inside the cell. Okay, so what's this charge inside the cell that has to oppose potassium leaving? Does it have to be a positive charge or negative charge? Okay. Well, potassium is positive. It's going to be attracted inside the cell. Inside the cell has to be a little bit negative, right? So the charge inside the cell has to be negative. So at equilibrium, okay, there has to be a difference in concentration and there has to be a charge on the membrane. Those two forces are going to cancel out and then potassium won't move one way or the other. And that's what we call the equilibrium potential. The equilibrium potential describes the voltage across the cell membrane if only one ion could diffuse. And we were just talking about potassium, not just one species of elements. Not, that means forget about calcium, forget about chlorine and sodium. Okay, so if the membrane is permeable only to potassium, it would diffuse until it reaches its equilibrium potential. This E stands for potential, so this stands for the equilibrium potential for potassium, right? We just kind of did this on the board. That is, that equilibrium is what? When the concentration gradient, the force for pushing potassium out of the cell due to the concentration gradient is exactly equal to the voltage on the cell that's trying to suck potassium in, right? That's that equilibrium when there's no change. All right, so potassium ion is attracted inside the cell by these trapped ions. It's driven out by the concentration gradient at the equilibrium, right? The electrical and diffusion forces are what? Equal and opposite, and potassium won't move one way or the other. All right, so there's a concentration gradient and an electrical gradient at the same time. We call that an electrical chemical potential. And if we put a voltmeter on the cell, we see that the voltage that has to develop on the membrane to resist, right, diffusion of potassium by the concentration gradient is minus 90 millivolts. So there has to be an additional minus 90 millivolts of charge inside the cell to prevent calcium from what? Escaping, from going down its concentration gradient. So that's what we call the equilibrium potential. And when that happens, you have a negative charge inside the cell compared to the outside. So here we have a voltmeter. This is the ground electrode. That's the measuring electrode. We put the measuring electrode inside the cell, and voila, the meter moves to the left, and it's going to show minus 90 millivolts. So what's minus 90? So 90 millivolts is equal to 0.090 volts. So it's kind of a small voltage, okay, but it's not that small. If we had a couple hundred cells together, right, they were up at a volt already. All right, so that's how the equilibrium potential or equilibrium voltage gets established. Why? Because of these fixed anions inside the cell bringing potassium in. And the charge balances out the potential that's produced by the concentration gradient. Okay, you might have to read that over a couple times in the textbook. Well, there is an equation that can tell you what the equilibrium potential is for a particular ion, all right, with a typical cell. And that equation is called the Nernst equation. So here's a slide of the Nernst equation. It gives the membrane voltage needed to counteract the concentration forces acting on an ion. And the concentration forces could be either pulling it in or pushing it out, depending on the concentration gradient. The value of this equilibrium potential depends on the ratio of ion concentrations inside and outside the cell membrane. So here is the equation, right? Here's the equilibrium potential. And these are just some constants. The 61 is just something that makes the units all match up correctly. The Z right here is the electrical charge or the valence of an ion. And you already know your valences, right? Right, for instance, here is Cl, here is sodium, here is potassium, here is calcium, here's magnesium. These are the real ions that are in solution in our body. So what's the valence of magnesium? 2 is half correct. It is plus 2. Chlorine is minus 1. Sodium is plus 1. Potassium is plus 1. And what's calcium? Plus 2. Right? So the valence is the number of the charge, but also the magnitude if it's plus or minus. And so that's the number somebody would put in here for Z. if it was chlorine or if it's, so if it was magnesium, Z would be what? If it was magnesium, you'd put here for Z, 2. If it's chlorine, it would be minus 1. Okay, minus 1. It would have an opposite effect on the membrane because it has the opposite charge compared to these cations right here. And right here, you would put the concentrations of that particular ion on the outside of the cell and in the denominator on the inside of the cell. And so if you wanted to calculate this with your calculator, you get these two concentrations, divide the outside by the inside, then take the log of it, so you have to know how to push your little log button. Okay, and then multiply it by either 61, right, if that was a plus 1, or minus 61 if it was a chloride, or what, what's 2 times 61? 122 for magnesium, right, or calcium. And that would give you, in millivolts, the equilibrium potential. And that is the electrical charge that's necessary to what? To counteract the diffusion of that ion outside the cell due to its concentration gradient. All right, so the Nernst equation can do that. The trouble with the Nernst equation is that you can only calculate it for one ion at a time. We can't put all the ions together in this equation, and we know in our body all those ions are there all the time. All right, but nonetheless, we can go ahead and calculate it for these various ions, and you should get a feel for this slide, okay, because it tells you what the concentration gradient is in normal living cells. So in a normal living cell, where is sodium higher, on the inside or outside of the cell? Yes, 12 millimolar versus 145 on the outside. What about potassium? It's higher on the inside, 150 millimolar versus 5 millimolar. All right, chlorine, it's higher outside the cell, 9 millimolar versus 125 millimolar on the outside. And calcium, look at that. You hardly have any calcium inside the cell, calcium ions, but it's relatively high outside the cell. So again, there is a gradient. So you could calculate the equilibrium potential for potassium. What numbers would you use? These two right here, right? So this would be in the numerator, this would be in the denominator, and what would be Z? What would be Z? Plus 1, all right? And for sodium, ignoring all these others, right, for sodium, you would have, right, this in the denominator now, so a big number instead of a small one, and then 12 millimolar in the denominator, and Z still would be plus 1. Punch it through your calculator, and you could practice doing this at home, but I think I have it on the next slide.
Do we need to know the
number? No, you don't have to know. On the test, you don't have to be able to do the calculation, for instance, but you have. What do you have to know for the test? Let me go back. You have to know what equation describes, I could ask a question, what equation describes how the concentration force is balanced by the electrical force to maintain a gradient across the cell, or to what voltage, what equation is used to determine the voltage that's necessary to maintain a concentration gradient across the cell? And you would say Nernst equation, okay? The other thing that you see on this slide right here, you should have a feel for what the concentration gradient is for sodium, potassium, chloride, and calcium. I'm not going to ask you for these numbers, but you should at least know where sodium is highest, outside. Where's potassium highest? Inside. What about chlorine? Outside. And calcium. And calcium is real important to know where it's highest. It's highest, just like sodium, okay, on the outside of the cell. Because we're going to start messing around with this voltage a little bit. Okay, the cell messes around with this all the time. For instance, okay, well, we know at rest that the inside of the cell is electrically what compared to the outside? The inside of the cell is negative, right? So what happens if all of a sudden the cell allows some sodium to enter? Does the inside of the cell become more negative or less negative when sodium enters? It gets less negative, that's right, because this cation is going to neutralize some of the electrical charges. So the cell changes the voltage, right, depending on different states of excitation by these currents. Sodium current, it's a current because why? It has an electrical charge on it. Okay, just like when we flip a switch in a room. Okay. And for instance, if the cell lets calcium in, what's going to happen to the membrane potential? It starts at minus 90 and it's going to get The more positive is, these positive ions move inside the cell. And the cell can change its metabolism and other things that are happening inside the cell by letting those currents happen or not happen. All right, so at rest, that means when the cell is not being stimulated. All right, that, as a matter of fact, that was that previous slide. At rest, this is the concentration of ions that we have, or the concentration gradient that we have within a cell. And if we add all of these things up, all right, we have the resting membrane potential. And in a normal cell, it's anywhere between minus 65 and minus 85 millivolts. Because we have to add all those ions up together. It's just not the sodium that we measured with the Nernst equation, which was minus 90. But if we add all of those together, we get this range right here. And it's stationary. It's stable. It just stays at that voltage if nothing is happening to that cell. And so if it's stationary and the cell isn't doing anything, we call it what? Resting. That's the resting membrane. And potential is just another word for voltage. And the resting membrane potential depends on the concentrations of the ions inside and out. How would you calculate, or how could you calculate the voltage across the membrane, knowing the concentrations of ions across the membrane? What's the name of that equation? That's Nernst. Yeah, the Nernst equation. But it also depends on permeability of each ion. Okay, because if we said if a positive ion goes inside the cell, right, that can change the membrane potential, so permeability is important. And the resting membrane potential is most affected by potassium because potassium actually is very permeable to the membrane. Sodium is not, calcium is not, but potassium is. Okay. All right, so resting membrane potential, I don't know, I think I talked about that already. Okay, here is another thing that helps maintain the resting membrane potential, all right, and that is a sodium-potassium ATP pump. Because what is this pump doing? It's maintaining a concentration gradient across the cell, and if we look at that concentration gradient, we can, with the Nernst equation, measure the voltage. And the sodium-potassium pump, oh, we didn't talk about this, is a little discriminative when it comes to sodium and potassium. It doesn't pump equal numbers of sodium and potassium across the membrane. It is two potassiums for every sodium. All right, so it's not an even exchange of charge. All right, so if this pump is working, eventually, what side is going to be more negative, or what side is going to be more positive? You should maybe have an intuitive sense for how that's going. If the pump pumps out more positive charges than positive charges pumping in, then the inside eventually is going to get more negative, and the outside is going to get more positive because the outside is receiving more positive charges than the inside is, right, in that ratio of 2 to 3. Right, so that increases the resting membrane potential by about these 3 millivolts. So here is a little summary of the resting membrane potential. First off, right, if there are no fixed ions inside the cell, no fixed anions inside the cell, what would be the concentration gradient for potassium? There would be no concentration gradient, right? So it would equalize by diffusion. But if we put anions inside the cell, that's going to draw extra positive ions in. Right? So those fixed anions draw potassium inside the cell, creates that concentration gradient. You have unequal permeabilities of the plasma membrane to these diffusible ions. Namely, it's very permeable to potassium, but it's not permeable to sodium. That produces an electrical potential. The sodium-potassium pump also helps produce that membrane potential because it's pumping out 3 sodiums and only 2 potassiums to the inside of the cell. So we have an uneven distribution of ions across the plasma membrane. And because of that concentration gradient, we get different equilibrium potentials. And if we add all of the equilibrium potentials together and factor in permeability and the effects of the sodium-potassium ATP pump, we end up with a resting membrane potential on a typical cell of minus 70. Okay, so we just can't add the equilibrium potential for potassium and sodium together, because what would that be? That would be like minus 24. That's not it, because there's other factors, the sodium potassium pump and these fixed anions that produce a resting membrane potential of minus 70 millivolts across the membrane. All right, so that is the resting membrane potential. So to get a feel for that, start with a cell without any negative charges on the inside, and then realize that if you just have potassium and let it diffuse, it's going to have an equal concentration on the outside and inside. But if we put a lot of negative charges inside the cell, that's going to do what? Pull more potassium inside the cell. And so there's going to be an imbalance in charge. And that imbalance in charge is what we call the equilibrium potential for that particular ion. Okay. Well, let's see, over the weekend, you can look at this slide, so I won't talk about this very much. This is just from anatomy. I guess I'm going to start here next time. Okay, cell signaling. We've got a couple more PowerPoint slides to look at, so I'm going to start here next time. Make a note of that, and maybe look this over a little bit over the weekend. Okay. Okay, we have not many more slides. This right here is an exam figure. You can look at this figure, too, over the weekend. All right, as well as start looking at that web material stuff, and if somebody had questions about getting that material from ARIS, what is it, ARIS.MHHE.com? So maybe I'll just go there right now and see what's happening. I don't know if it's misbehaving or not, but let me just see if I can do that. Okay, let's see, so I'm going to close this off. So the first thing we got to do is see if we have an internet connection. And we may not. And I think we do. All right, so, okay, so let's just go to what? ARIS.MHHE. ARIS? ARIS.MHHE. Okay? That's what I have up there. But I did a little shortcut, because you don't have to type the whole URL into the address line. You can just type what I put right there, and then if I hit Control Enter, it's going to add the .com, and it's going to add the http://, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. All right, so if I hit Enter, it's not going to know what to do, but if I hit Control Enter, see, it added all that stuff properly? Okay, and now it redirected you to this site. So your book publisher has put a redirection in, so you don't have to type this whole name right here. And what would you do? Well, you could say select the subject. It's going to be what? Anatomy and Physiology. All right, and then you got to select your book, which is Fox 10. And then I didn't hit anything. Now, again, the website is going to redirect you to this particular textbook. And you don't need a password. You don't need a sign-in, a username, or a password. You just would do what? Go to Resources right here. Notice a cursor changed from an arrow to a little hand. So just hit Resources. Now, if you bookmark this right here, you should be able to get to this page without going through all those other redirects. So let's do that. Maybe I have it as a bookmark already. So we're going to say what? Add to Favorites, ARIS, and let me just put Fox, because that's the textbook we're using, right here. And we say OK. All right, so we don't have to go to ARIS.MHHE next time. And if I hit Resources, then for Chapter 6, here we go for Chapter 6. I don't know if we have any good animations, labeling exercises. Probably not. This is all from Anatomy. None available. But you certainly want to look at what? Quizzes. Like, fill in the blank, yeah, true, false, multiple choice. All right. Now, somebody in one of my other classes tried to do this the night before the test. and they said that the website wasn't working, or maybe they just never learned how to mouse around and find it. Okay, and so they didn't have the luxury of looking at all these questions before the test. So maybe the website was down, and maybe the website will be down next week. I don't know. So what is really wise to do? Maybe do it tonight, print these out, and then you have it. Okay. Oh, the website actually did go down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, should I don't know if I should show you how to do this or not, but I'll show you. I'll show you. Okay, so you can go to the end. Okay, you can, okay. Okay, so what I have done, okay, is like I start here, and I go to the bottom, blah, 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 down to someplace maybe right here, then I hit shift and click, so now I've selected this, and I hit control copy, okay, and then what can you do? Yeah. Yeah. So then you could start, I don't have a Word problem, a Word program. So just paste it into Word and then you have it on your hard drive. But don't forget to save it after you paste it in there. Okay. I don't think we're good. I don't know if I'll have it ready by then. Okay. So you'll have to do, I think you're allowed one makeup in here.
Yeah. Well, so
okay.
It's a lot of money for me, and I pretty much pick them up from school, take them home, cook them dinner, do like the whole nine yards, and play mom for 4 days while they're out of town. But I won't know for sure until tomorrow anyway, so that's why I was wondering.
I might postpone the test.
Okay.
For everybody.
Okay.
So come back next week.
That's to my advantage, because I was going to come to the, like, if...
Babysitting, is that that's really a tough call for an instructor to get, let somebody out of an exam for babysitting.
Well, it's not babysitting, it's like literally, like, watching the kids for 4 days.
I understand.
So, and I know, like, I work and then I'd be picking them up from school and then...
I'll let you know. Not guaranteed. I mean, I usually let people out of an exam, like if they get called to active duty.
Yeah.
If somebody dies in the family. Yeah. Okay. So that kind of thing. So if they're reserve firemen or policemen or something, and you know they have emergencies to deal with, but
that's why it's debatable. Yeah. I don't want to take it today, because if I take it on Wednesday, say we have this test, taking it on Wednesday too, like two tests, because I have my Kim class.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Daniel Leche or whatever, who's in the other class.
Uh-huh.
We have Kim together, and I don't know how he does two tests in one day.
You know, I'll try to figure that out. I don't think we're supposed to have it next week anyway. It would be the week after on a Tuesday, I think.
Yeah, next week.
Next week.
Is that next week Thursday?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, we won't have.
I thought we're all, like, jam-packing studying again.
Great. Great.
Is it going to be on chapters?
4, 5, and 6.
Is that 7, 8, 9?
No, 4, 5, and 6.
But is that going to be?
No, because we're not done with talking about all that stuff. Okay. Okay, have a nice weekend.
Thank you.